Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good evening, everyone. Welcome to Web Sleuths Radio. I'm so glad you're with us tonight. Let's get this goo out of the way. We call it legal goo. The opinions expressed on this show are those of the guests and the host, and of course, I take no responsibility for them, especially my own. Web Sleuths Radio is not the same as WebSleuths.com, which is a completely different corporate entity. So if you get mad and you throw a tantrum at something we say on Web Sleuths Radio, blame me, not the corporate entity of WebSleuths.com. Kimster is our executive producer. She is also an administrator at WebSleuths.com. And a lot of people do not know this about Kimster, but Kimster leads the nation in her macrosomatic abilities. Absolutely amazing. Look it up, macrosomatic. Tonight, we welcome Robin Sachs from Fox News LA. Robin is a former prosecutor, and she's going to update us on the latest in the death of Whitney Houston. I know there have been some new reports coming out, slowly trickling out, and it's just a very, very sad picture. And she'll also talk to us about the memorial service yesterday. Later in the show, private investigator Ron Rugen will tell us the latest in the search for missing baby Lisa Irwin. Ron has been on that case since day one. He lives very close to Lisa's house, and he has put a lot of his own time and his own money, not getting paid a cent, but he is working on that case night and day. And we'll talk to Ron about the Lisa Irwin case a little bit later on. But first, what is the lowest place on the earth? Supposedly, it is on the shore of the Dead Sea, 1,388 feet below sea level. Actually, I think I found a place even lower. And that is Josh Powell's father and many from that side of the family, not all, but many, with their attempts to have Josh buried next to the children he brutally murdered. That's as low as they come. Josh's mother did issue a statement on CNN saying Josh will not be buried in the same cemetery as Charlie and Braden. Thank you, God. Earlier, Crime Stoppers and the Sheriff's Department purchased burial plots around the boys to make sure Josh would not be buried next to them. So, the thing is, it looks like somebody with a heart realized how horrid it would be for Charlie and Braden's loved ones to have to look at a headstone with the name of their murderer on it. Even if Josh wasn't right next to them, just knowing he was there, it would be absolutely awful. So, anyway, tonight, we're going to be talking with, in just a moment, Susan Powell's father, Chuck Cox, and we're trying to get him on the phone right now. And Kimster, are you able to come on and tell us what's going on?
Well, I'm having trouble dialing his number. Something going on here with the screening room, so I'm going to keep trying, though.
Okay. You know what? Why don't you go ahead and try him on your cell and ask him to call in real quickly. Okay.
Sounds good to me.
Why don't you try that, and then we don't have to worry about it and try and do it that way. We'll see if it works. Okay, we've got a couple of people in our chat room. We have Stacy Sabatino, Sharon, just listening today. Hello, everybody. Now, the people in our chat room, or somebody can call in if they'd like. Our number is 760-825-0933. That's 760-825-0933. If you'd like to call and talk about Josh Powell and that whole situation with the burial of the boys. And if anybody has a question in the chat room, just let us know. We would love to find out your questions. But I find it interesting that Chuck Cox, Susan's father, is so easily... You can contact him very easily. A lot of times, especially parents in cases like this, it's difficult to talk to them. They don't want to talk to you. They're sick of talking to you, but not Mr. Cox. He is a true man of incredible patience and love. Like he told me last week, he said, please let everybody know that I don't want people, trashing other people and trashing the families and saying bad things. It's all about forgiveness with him and about love. And if you ever want to see a man who is truly a man that is not a hypocrite, who is loving and giving and has the most incredible heart, it is Chuck Cox and his wife and their whole family, as a matter of fact, the whole Cox family. Absolutely one of the most amazing, amazing people. amazing group of people I've ever come across. They are Mormons, and being that I live in Utah, I can talk a little bit about the Mormon faith. I am not a Mormon myself, but I will tell you one thing. The Mormons do get a bad rap a lot of times, and when there is a tragedy in somebody's family, when somebody has a problem, whether they're Mormon or not, it's the Mormons who are right there, first off, to help somebody, to help you if you need it, be you Mormon or not. That's what they do. And they do get a bad rap a lot of times. But trust me, having grown up and lived amongst the Mormons, very, very wonderful people. But as in all cases, there's always bad with the good. Anyway, Kimster, any luck? Oh, I believe we do have Mr. Cox. Mr. Cox, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Mr. Cox, thank you so much for joining me. And I know you have somewhere to go tonight, so we will take this we'll make this very, very short for you. Mr. Cox, this is a rhetorical question. When is this nightmare going to end? I know you are a kind man, and you don't want to say bad things about people, but when I heard about the wishes to bury Josh next to his boys, and then even in the same cemetery, I'm sorry, but that was as low as that family has ever gone in even suggesting that. Your thoughts, please?
I agree. I have to admit, though, I was not surprised, because to even think that basically shows a complete disregard of any natural, respect for persons or any idea of normalcy.
Well, that's it exactly, Mr. Cox. We're talking with Chuck Cox, Susan Cox Powell's father, and about the fact that some members of Josh's family wanted him buried next to the boys that he brutally murdered, and then not just next to, but in the same cemetery. And like you said, Mr. Cox, it goes to show that that Josh's father is so out of touch with being a human being in general. God forbid, please, dear God, if something happened and my son ever killed somebody, a member of his family, I would be a mess. I would do whatever I could to make things easier for the people who had lost the loved one. But Mr. Powell has no ability to do that. He's just thinking of what he wants, and he apparently didn't see any problem with that. He couldn't understand what the big deal was. And I like I said, I know you're very forgiving and very kind, but it was the lowest of the low. What have you heard about anything going on in Susan's case, anything going on with Josh's father? I think everybody believes now that he might know. He does know. I believe he does know where Susan is. Can you tell us any updates?
Well, I think Josh's dad has always been on the radar screen of the police. They know who he is and what he is, and I think he's always been there. The police now have to go back. I mean, the person they were hoping to put in jail and get to tell them where Susan was and tell us what all happened is no longer part of the solution here, part of the situation. He took himself out. And on the way out, he said he was sorry for everyone he hurt. I took that as a confession, frankly. But mm-hmm. So now they have to look at their case and decide where to go from here and how many other people could have been involved or were involved and what are their cases still relevant to do, and they're not giving up on searching for Susan. So I think they're just going to keep on working it.
Well, that is good to hear, and I'm glad to hear that you feel confident of that as well. When you say they're searching for Susan, are you talking about the police, West Valley, and the people and the police in Seattle? Are they still working together? What's going on there?
As far as I know, well, Josh thinking he could move out of West Valley City and things were going to die off was just pure stupidity. Anyone would know that, but evidently he didn't. But anyway, they have been working, and I'm sure they will continue to work together to tie up all the loose ends on here, because with Susan's case, it brought out to Steve Powell's strangeness and the things that his family did and all his perversions and stuff. So they still have lots of things they need to work together on. I'm sure they will continue to do so.
And that is good to know. And I don't know if you can answer this, but do you think that Josh was abused by his father in any way, shape, or form, physically, sexually? I just wonder if there was really some horrid perversion going on.
Well, from the I don't know what his family life was like. He never said anything, or I have nothing to suggest that he was physically abused or sexually abused or anything like that. But his dad's view of reality that was passed on to the children, and his complete lack of respect for any authority or religion or anything, I consider a form of abuse. And I do think he had he was taught wrong from the beginning, and that whole everybody that lived in that atmosphere was poisoned by these same ideals. And Steve himself said he had a abusive childhood or problems, and so hopefully this just stops the cycle.
Yes, and that is the truth. That is exact. That's what it's all about, is stopping the cycle. It needed to be stopped. We do have a question from the chat room, and I know you have to run, so I won't make this a very long interview at all. Are they going to be able to force Steve Powell to take any sort of polygraph test? Do you know that? Do you know if he's taken one, or they're trying to get him to take one?
Yeah, I doubt it. I doubt they will for right now, because frankly, with the voyeurism charge and child pornography charges, he's looking at, by my count, at least 30 years in prison. And I don't think he's got any motivation to do it, because I think anything he would say would probably incriminate him more in Susan's disappearance. And in that case, you know, unless he, for some strange reason, he wasn't directly involved in something, and he just feels the need to suddenly become compassionate and tell us what happened or where she is, and I don't believe that's going to happen.
I want to tell you that Vita K and all of our members are saying they're praying for you and your wife's health, and that you remain healthy, and you will, of course, always have our support. One more quick question. Would you be for a deal with Stephen Powell, perhaps to get a reduced sentence if he does tell us where Susan is?
Well, you know, nothing is going to bring my daughter back. And nothing's going to bring the boys back. We know they're safe together. We know that nothing can harm the boys again. He had many opportunities to do something. If it would knock a few years off but still mean that he would get out when he was 90 years old or something, then, yeah, I suppose if he'll tell us where she is, that would be okay. But I think he's going to be in the jail for a long time, and how he'll fare in jail I don't think is going to be bodes well for him, based on the type of crimes he's committed and his son's committed. So I don't know. I don't think it's worth I think police will find her with or without them eventually, and I just don't think it'd be worth to let somebody like that back out on the streets. If that's the case, certainly not. If it was to knock a few years off, yeah, I would like to know where my daughter is.
Well, again, Mr. Cox, on behalf of Web Sleuths, all of our members and Web Sleuths Radio, we are praying and we are with you and in spirit, and anything you need, you have my number, and I am so serious about that. Listen, I will let you go. Thank you so much. I know you're incredibly busy. We will keep on top of this, and we'll be talking with you soon in the near future. Thank you, Mr. Cox.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. We're talking with Chuck Cox. That was Susan Cox Powell's father. Oh, what a man. The man is just amazing. Robin Sachs, are you there?
I am here.
Did you hear that? Is he not an amazing man?
Oh, God. I mean, it's just a total amazing man. And to be here to share with us some insight is so very important. I know that it's so, so completely difficult. I can't, you know, there's no benefit to him necessarily to coming on other than to give your listeners some insight and understanding, which hopefully will help bring about some sort of justice for him, but also to let people kind of know that there are human beings behind these papers.
Exactly. We're talking with Robin Sachs. Welcome, Robin. Robin is a former prosecutor and is now on Fox News LA. And we just finished with Chuck Cox, Susan Cox Powell's father. And you're right, Chuck Cox does not need to come on this show. He doesn't need to talk to me. I mean, I was shocked when he picked up the phone a while back and I started the conversation with him. But he and his wife and his whole family truly appreciate the support. And that's why he's doing it. That's why he's going on all the shows and talking with everybody, because he wants everyone to know how much he appreciates what they do. Robin Sachs, thank you so much. I've been wanting to have you on my show forever. How are you doing, my dear?
I'm doing as good as I can do. Actually, great. I saw the Harlem Globetrotters today. How bad can life be when you're at the Harlem Globetrotters, right?
I love them. They're so much fun. Now, I wanted to talk to you because you're out there. You're in the know. And everybody's talking about Whitney. It was such a tragedy, not the least bit unexpected. I mean, it was just a matter of when, which was so tragic in itself. What's the latest? Last I heard, she was drinking heavily and doing handstands by the pool. What have you heard about Whitney Houston?
Well, I got to tell you a lot of things. I mean, you really epitomize the sentiment that I think we all feel, and the tragedy behind everything. And the fact of the matter is, you're right. It's, while we all have been shocked, there is very little surprise. I mean, this is, you know, another Hollywood tragedy. And, you know, we spend so much time talking about the signs and symptoms of abuse and child abuse and sexual assault and domestic violence and stalking and kind of all these, you know, horrific crimes that face everyday folks all the time. And yet there's a whole world of abuse that affects our celebrity friends and regular people as well. And she'd be no stranger to the pain that so many people live with. And she was. She was someone who's, you know, if you look back at her history, just as we all do to kind of see if we can understand how we got from point A to point B, you can see all the signs and symptoms there. I mean, she had a horrific struggle with drug addiction, both in the world of illicit drugs and prescription drugs. And, you know, what's going on here in Los Angeles is kind of what we saw and what we felt in the world of the Conrad Murray, Michael Jackson cases. Is mm-hmm. there someone that we can somehow hold responsible, or someone who could have done something within her circle or where, what have you, that could have helped prevent this tragedy? And right now here in Los Angeles, last week there was an investigation, or the case is being deemed a death investigation at this moment, which, by the way, for your listeners, that's exactly what the Michael Jackson case was, a death investigation. And mm-hmm. if you recall, and I was following that case very closely, as you know, many of the missteps in terms of and the fears in terms of whether there was going to be a successful prosecution had to do with the fact that the very beginning parts of the investigation were done by the coroner's office, because they were the ones looking at what the facts and circumstances are behind the death. And that's exactly what's going on right now. Right now, it's a coroner's investigation, but they are working side by side with Beverly Hills Police Department and various other agencies looking into this prescription drug cartel. Is there a Dr. Feelgood or several Dr. Feelgoods? Who are the enablers? Who are the people that may have contributed to her demise?
Well, Robin, I don't know if you're aware of this, but you can get a lot of those drugs on the internet, and you have been able to for years. The doctors are at the Rock of Gibraltar, Lebanon, I mean, all over the place, you know, so she could have had people on the internet getting her drugs. I think it's easy to get drugs, no matter what. I could, you know, it's so easy, it's sickening.
It's so easy, but I'll tell you, you know, you'd be surprised how hard the internet may be. I mean, I would find it fascinating, actually, if there was an internet connection here, just because the enablers in the celebrity world are all the people who want to be close, all the protectors, all the people who want to hang out with, you know, the cool people, you know, all mm-hmm. those types of people. And certainly, you know, They doctor shop. I mean, I was very involved in reporting on the Anna Nicole Smith case. I mean, then you have Keith Ledger and Brittany Murphy. I mean, there is one case after another of people who, you know, provide prescriptions. And it'll be very interesting to find, you know, one of the anomalies or the things that, you know, spectators are talking about right now is that there were not necessarily a lot of prescriptions, drug medication found in Whitney's room on the day that she died last week. Mm-hmm. But that does not necessarily mean that, you know, even the smallest drug amount with the wrong interaction, or the one that, you know, just like with Michael Jackson, I mean, it was propofol, something that should never be administered in a home setting, period, was
right,
enough to be able to hold someone accountable. So it'll be very interesting what the toxicology and the pathology say, but that doesn't necessarily mean that even at that point, I mean, if you recall Conrad Murray and Michael Jackson, there was not an immediate arrest after the toxicology and pathology came out. I mean, that's just kind of step one, first to figure out what was in her system. What was in her system doesn't match with what the toxicology says. And then the step two, three, four, and five is what's going on, which is going and looking in her medicine cabinets and her purse and her suitcase and and all the other places to see how many pharmacies, and we saw that Mickey Fine was raided, or not raided, but at least we're looking at subpoenaed again, which was a Michael Jackson pharmacy, and seeing which doctors she was seeing. Was she on the Attorney General's Do Not Prescribe To list? Were there prescriptions that were potentially done in other people's names, like in the Anna Nicole Smith case? I mean, this is the beginning of the whodunit right now.
Right, exactly. And you know what? They may find that she was just able to go around and get enough doctors and enough drugs to do the damage without there being a doctor feel good. That's a scary thing. But isn't there in California, let's say Whitney Houston or anybody was doctor shopping for, what was it she had, Xanax. If someone gets a prescription for Xanax at Dr. A, and then a week later they go to Dr. B and get another prescription for Xanax, doesn't that pop up a red flag and stop it?
Well, that's exactly. There is, the Attorney General does maintain a do not prescribe list, or a warning for the people, the actual patients who may be getting prescriptions. And so one has to wonder, that's the first question, is was she on that list? Was she someone that was flagged? Let me tell you, let's cut to the chase here. There's a bigger problem. The bigger problem is this. Our society still will look at Whitney's death, whether or not she had doctors or not. There will be a fair number of people out there who will think, you know what, she's responsible for her own death.
You're right. You're right.
She chose to take him. She doctor shopped. She did it. And you know what? There's no one to hold responsible except for her. And that is what the struggle is from a prosecutor's perspective, as to that mentality. When a DA's office is trying to determine whether or not they file charges, they have to look at, am I going to be able to convince 12 people beyond a reasonable doubt that this person is guilty? And that, in Michael Jackson and Conrad Murray, that was, so much of a slam dunk case only because it was propofol. Xanax is something that you do prescribe to people at home. People do take it. And how is one doctor to know from what another doctor is? And if the AG's office doesn't have you on a do not prescribe list. So there's something, it feels like there's this incredible void. And I got to tell you, Tony Bennett's comments strike me as completely absurd. While I actually believe in the legalization of some drugs, i.e. marijuana, I don't believe that the legalization of drugs would have prevented her death at all.
Oh, absolutely not. I think if we legalized all drugs, you would just see a lot more drug addicts. But I agree. To me, marijuana, it's so much money spent down the drain when it could be controlled. And anyway, that's a whole other show, but I agree with you on that, Robin. Okay, so we stand now. We are just basically hearing rumors. I'm sure the Inquirer will have a big, huge story on it. In fact, it's probably already out. I have not been able to get a copy of it, but I'm sure they've got some scoop. And let's face it, Robin, the Inquirer comes up right a lot of times nowadays, especially since OJ, right?
I got to tell you, I used to be one of those people who would flip up my nose at some of these magazines, websites, or places that were often known as yellow journalism. And I got to tell you, the yellow has been bringing in the green, because they've been green and correct on so many things. And the fact of the matter is, that's a whole other issue in terms of cases right now. I mean, the whole aspect of media has really, really changed. Now people are getting, due to the fact that National Enquirer and TMZ and Radar and these places pay for their stories, people who have information know that, and they do provide their information to the people who pay for it. And yes, you have to look at it with the same skepticism, as you would any news source, frankly, because, a lot of stuff is out there, hearsay and what have you. But in terms of these National Enquirer and TMZ and other reports, I'm telling you, I'm saying 90% of the time these things are coming up true.
I know. It is absolutely amazing. We're talking with Robin Sachs. Robin is with Fox News LA, former prosecutor, and we're talking about the tragic but not unexpected death of Whitney Houston. And, Robin, we could do hours and hours and weeks and months on drug addiction. To me, drug addiction is the symptom. You got to dig down deep to get to the root of the problem and fix it. And I think that's one thing that we as a society need to understand. Yes, it is the responsibility of the person taking the drugs, absolutely, but why are they taking the drugs? And as a society of caring people, we need to find out why and need to find out how we can stop it. Am I right or am I wrong? Am I like off my rocker? What do you think?
No, I totally agree. I mean, I think the fact of the matter is that these are cries for help. And just like, I mean, I kind of look at drug addicts like children. We don't, and they are. I mean, they've got impaired judgment. They have the inability to make rational decisions. They can't have the ability to consent or know what they're doing to. And just like there's laws that say, you know, when you're a minor, you know, whether you think you're having consensual sex or not, it's not consent mm-hmm. because we don't believe that you have the brain capacity to make a consensual decision. So is it with drug addiction. I mean, granted, I think that the criminal justice system, the role isn't not necessarily the same kinds of punishment. So, you know, incarcerating addicts isn't necessarily going to solve the issue. But I think that we're failing, and we're failing miserably. And I think as a society, we have to look at these are people who can't consent, and we can't mm-hmm. hold people responsible. And we can, and we do, but we can't hold them solely responsible and say, listen, oh, this was the death as to their own, you know, this, you know, it's the equivalent of a suicide. Because I don't think that, you know, Whitney Houston, who, you know, let her aunt lay out her clothes for her to perform at Clive Davis's party, was intending to kill herself.
Exactly, exactly right. And I think one thing I have learned through, I've been to pretty intense therapy myself, which is a whole other show. And one thing I have learned is that when you have situations, and, you know, I know people are going to roll their eyes, but when you have situations in your childhood that you don't deal with, and then you grow up, it comes out some way, whether it's gambling, drugs, shopping, you know, hoarding, whatever, it comes out and you need to deal with it. And I wish people would stop just saying, pick yourself up by your bootstraps. Yeah, you have to pick yourself up, but you need a little help once in a while, especially if you're deeply, deeply troubled like Whitney Houston was. And I just hope we can start to be less judgmental and more helpful. I don't have all the answers. I just know the answer isn't to throw people in prison all the time and not give them help. Make them responsible for what they do, absolutely. They commit a crime, no question. They need to be punished for it. But they also need the other side so they can get help so they don't go out about committing crimes again. It's such a big, huge problem. And you, Robin, in L.A., I mean, my God, I can't even imagine the depths of the drug abuse out there. Well, it's everywhere, but you see it constantly.
Listen, I got to tell you, I mean, I think the thing that's so sad or so not sad, but I think the thing that should be, you know, an opportunity for us all here is to recognize, like, Whitney Houston is a unbelievable example, just like Michael Jackson, of people who, you know, Heath Ledger and Anna Nicole Smith, of people who've had everything. You know, they have all the money. You know, all of us mm-hmm. regular folks out there go, oh, if I only had this, I wouldn't be depressed. And if I only had that, I wouldn't abuse this and what have you. And I think the point, you bring a good point, whether it's your childhood, whatever it is, we all suffer in some form or another. And there's mm-hmm. just different ways. And there are. I mean, we all find different ways to cope. But I think that coping is just, you know, making it through and not fixing and addressing. And we do. We have to really open our eyes and hearts and minds to people. And I feel bad for the celebrities. I mean, look at Demi Moore right now. I mean, her 911 tape, she's in the worst shallows of her life, and her 911 tape is being released. She can't, you know, mm-hmm. even they can't escape the public scrutiny, and it's not fair to them.
Exactly. We have a lot of people, Robin, asking in our chat room about Bobby Brown and the funeral. Did he left pouting? Was he asked to leave or to move because he had a big entourage? What's the story behind Bobby Brown?
You know, it's interesting because I got conflicting. I mean, there's obviously the report that the mainstream media is making today that he apparently was let in, but there was an issue with seating having to do with his security guards, and then because of that, he ends up leaving. But I'll tell you, I was actually at a breakfast with somebody who is in the inner circles of media and had people like on the ground there inside the funeral itself, and there was definitely a feeling that he was asked to leave. Now, I don't know what's true. I was not there, so I don't want in any way, shape, or form people to think that I know or have insight. But I do think that regardless, whether he's asked to leave or he had an entourage or whatever it is, that, you know, something, somewhere, like this was going to be an issue. And mm-hmm. no wonder Whitney had an issue if there was that kind of conflict. And, you know, he still is the father of their child, their daughter, who's in such sad mourning right now.
Oh, that's the other
It's heartbreaking that a daughter couldn't be with her father at her mother's funeral regardless. And I don't know who's to blame for that. But if that's the struggle that Whitney Houston lived, no wonder.
No wonder, exactly. And let's talk about Bobby Christina, and then I know you have to run, but I want to touch on Bobby Christina for a moment. Adorable, adorable girl, young woman now, 18, very close to her mother. She was taken to the hospital upon learning of her mother's death. What is the latest on Bobby Christina, Robin?
You know, I'm reading the reports as you guys are reading them, I'm sure, which is that she had actually two hospital visits within the time of Whitney Houston's death, and actually there may have been one of them, I don't want to misquote this, that happened just prior to her death, and then she was readmitted following her mother's news, the news of her mother's death, and there's been some release of some pictures of her, and she is so depressed and so affected by this, and it's just, it's as clear as day, she could barely hold herself together, and frankly she was, you know, has kind of every right. I mean, she was turned away. And it's an interesting, again, I hate to bring up Michael Jackson again, but, you know, I'm sure that what was going through the minds of Beverly Hills Police Department during the very beginning stages of the investigation was they didn't want a situation where the family members potentially could come in and screw up the crime scene.
Right.
And, you know, Michael Jackson's family, you know, as you may know, right following his death, came in and removed items and what have you. So there's a balancing that has to go on here, but this is a child in crisis and potentially someone who also may be struggling with her own demons and abuse and everything else that may come out. I'm speculating, I'm not saying for certain, but this is someone that if I'm society and I'm the people within her inner circle, I'm keeping a close eye on this girl because all the telltale signs, and you lose your mom and support, it, you know, you're forever, ever changed.
Yes, and at such a young age, and I'm sorry, I don't see Bobby Brown being the pillar of strength for this child. Let's hope that there is enough from Whitney's side, perhaps on Bobby's side somewhere, to hold her up and get her the help she needs so we don't have another tragedy in the years to come, because she certainly deserves to live a good and wonderful life. She has a beautiful singing voice, from what I understand. So let's keep our fingers crossed and hope and pray for Bobby Christina. Well, Robin Sachs, thank you so much. I just appreciate you.
Before I go, I just want to say thank you to you and to all of your listeners and your sleuthers, because we have done some work, and we are going to continue doing work with some of your amazing stories because of you and your show and your avid crime fighters and sleuthers and advocates and people who care. We're able to bring some answers that law enforcement doesn't pick up on because you guys add your watchful eyes and your internet sleuthing skills to everything. And Tricia, you're just amazing, and I'm honored to be on your show.
Oh, Robin, thank you. I've got to give all the credit to the Web Sleuths members, though. They're the ones that do all the hard work. And for those of you who may not have been able to watch this, Robin Sachs has had Levi Page and myself on kind of a round table of true crime discussion with Fox LA, and we're going to keep doing that. We're going to be talking about the cases and the inside scoop that you don't hear everywhere in the mainstream media, and that was Robin's idea, and nobody else is doing it but Robin Sachs and Fox in LA, so thank you.
Well, we're gonna continue doing this together, and I think you guys are just amazing.
Yeah, well,
so
thank you. Thank you, my dear. You take care. Have a good night, and we'll talk to you real soon, okay?
You got it, Jill. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was Robin Sachs with Fox News LA, former prosecutor. You see her all the time, all over the place on all the cable news shows, because everybody wants to talk to her because she knows all the good stuff. Okay, and now holding ever so patiently one of my favorite people, Ron Rugen, PI, private investigator, right in the heart of the Lisa Irwin case. Ron, thank you for joining us.
It is always my pleasure, Tricia.
Well, there is so much to talk to you about. I don't even know where to begin. So we spoke earlier off the air. I kind of want to go over a little bit about the case players and what they're up to now to kind of update everybody. Baby Lisa Irwin went missing from her home in December, and no hide or hair of her. We can't find her. We don't know what the heck's going on. And Ron Rugen lives in the area and has been donating his time, his money, I mean, nonstop. This man is absolutely amazing in what he is doing for this case. And I'd like to thank Wise Old Al. Wise Old Al has a great list of case players on Web Sleuths in the Lisa Irwin case. It is in our featured case area. Go to websleuths.com/forums and scroll down, and you can see Lisa Irwin's case there. Let's start with Lisa's mother, who was home the night that Lisa Irwin went missing, said she put Lisa down and got up, and Lisa was gone. That's Deborah Bradley. What is the latest with Deborah Bradley, Ron Rubin?
Well, Deborah, along with her husband Jeremy and Joe Tacopina, have been on the Dr. Phil show. That was, I believe, February the 3rd. They left the previous weekend to go to fly to New York. Mike Lorette, whom we'll discuss him in a minute, that's the cousin from Texas. He came up. They all went to New York to meet Tacopina to do a satellite interview with Dr. Phil. And since that time, I have to be a little bit careful about what I say, not to betray any trust. But prior to the Dr. Phil show, I had spent face-to-face time with Deborah Bradley. The first occasion that we met, I happened to see her as I was driving through the neighborhood, and she was gracious to talk to me. We had a cordial conversation. We didn't really talk about the case. We just visited for about 50 minutes. The second time, I was in a location where she knew I was, and she came and sought me out. Jeremy dropped her off to talk to me, and she spent 4 hours visiting with me.
Wow. And
yeah.
I guess
that blows your mind, doesn't it?
It does. And I know you do have to be careful about what you say. Is there anything you can hint about, or you know, maybe
tap out
in code or something?
I will tell you, after the first meeting, it was a very cordial meeting. Like I said, after the first meeting, as I left, things don't look good sometimes on her story. A lot of people that I respect immensely, Peter Hyatt, Pat Brown, others, don't believe her story. But nonetheless, like I said, we had a cordial conversation. And as I left the first day, I gave her a hug and told her that I was praying for her. And that doesn't matter whether she's guilty of anything or totally innocent. She needs prayers either way, frankly, as a Christian. My attitude on that. The second time that I met with her, we discussed some ideas of some things that I could look into. I won't discuss any investigatory type of matters. She was, like on the Dr. Phil show, upset that day of things she was seeing about people saying to her on Facebook. And I counseled her and told her, you know, just don't look. It's like the tree that falls down in the forest. If you don't hear the tree, you know, it didn't fall. And,
exactly.
Whether she is culpable or not, people can be really mean. And Mark Class warned me of that back in November when we first started visiting. And Mark said, you know, one of the biggest suggestions I can give you, Ron, is don't read what people say about you because they're cruel. And if people are cruel to Mark Class, there's a special place in hell for them for that.
Boy, isn't that the truth? And you know what? They still are. I mean, to this day, I'll have people on Web Sleuth. Hasn't happened for a while, but they'll come on and just say something rotten. And I'm like, how could you say anything bad about Mark Class? My God, just makes
me
crazy.
He's a class act. He is. Yeah, we talk on a semi-regular basis. I don't talk to him by phone as much as I once did, but sometimes we'll visit on Facebook, on messaging. And Mark always has time to visit, and he's just a class act. And the man has been through a lot.
Yes.
As for Deborah Bradley, we visited, like I said, for 4 hours. She and I discussed, along with another individual, some ideas and some things that I could look into. I found it interesting because after the first discussion that she and I had, I found out through a third party that Bill Stanton chewed her out terribly for talking to me. And I don't fault the man for that because, I mean, she shouldn't be talking to me if they don't want her talking to people, you know.
Exactly.
But on the other hand, is she, you know, one angle on it could be, is she narcissistic and does what she wants to anyway? Or is she reaching out because she doesn't think enough is being done? I will tell you that from what I can see, that a lot of hers and Jeremy's actions so far in this whole situation has been based on, I think, a very tight rein by her quote-unquote team. I think that they honestly believe, or at least Jeremy does, I don't know about Deborah for sure, you know, since she reached out to me. But I think Jeremy believes that they're actually doing something. Now, I've never met Jeremy.
That was my next question. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I do know from, again, from third parties that he was always waiting for me to screw up. It seemed like he was always waiting for me to betray their trust.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's very suspicious of a lot of people around him. And so but I find it interesting that he brought Deborah where I was at and allowed her to spend time visiting with me. But since the Dr. Phil show, I've been totally cut off from any contact with them or members of the extended family. I was on the Jane Velez Mitchell show the night Dr. Phil show aired, and I was highly critical of their appearance on the Dr. Phil show. I felt like it was a bad idea. I felt, for a number of reasons, and of course I blogged about it and openly discussed on JVM.
Why did you think it was a bad idea? Wouldn't it be a good idea for them to get out and get some FaceTime, media time, tell their story, get people talking about the case again?
Tricia, that's the only positive thing that would come of it. But, you know, I think they need to be more in contact with law enforcement. Now, I will give them this. Admittedly, they have been in contact with the FBI, and it's not that visible out there. They have had contact, but I would rather see them, just my own opinion, down talking to law enforcement and even doing separate interviews with their attorney. Why wouldn't you do, I just don't get it, why wouldn't you do anything you could to help find your baby if you truly thought that you could find her?
And I agree. That is the eternal question that everybody wants to know, and their answer is what? I don't know. We're talking with Ron Rugen. Ron is the private investigator who has been involved and right in basically the whole case of Lisa Irwin, the toddler that went missing. And Ron, just to refresh our memories, hint, hint, my memory, let's talk about the night Lisa went missing just briefly and what Debbie says happened and what Jeremy said happened. So Lisa went missing what time and when was she discovered, and take it away.
Okay. Right prior to 5 o'clock, about a quarter to 5 that evening or 10 to 5, something like that, roughly, Deborah and brother Phil goes to the grocery store, and the infamous video of her getting a box of wine as well as a few jars of baby food, I believe it was. They come back sometime during that time period. James and Samantha Brando, the next-door neighbors, come home. They've been at counseling that afternoon. James told me last night, I visited with him last night, and he told me that they had a 1 o'clock counseling appointment, so I'm assuming that they had been back for a while. Deborah comes home. Fast forward till about 6:40, she claims is the last time that she looked in the crib to see her daughter, who had a slight cold or maybe an ear infection, I believe it was. And then she goes outside to her front porch, and Samantha comes over. Deborah has her box of wine. Samantha decides at one point that she wants to go get her own alcohol, and she leaves. I'm not sure the time frame there, and goes to get her own alcohol, comes back. Shane Beadley, from two doors down, you've got Jeremy and Deborah, and then next door to them are the Brandos, and then next door to them is Shane's grandmother. Shane Beagley comes over, has a smoke with him. He may not have had a drink, I don't know, but they had a smoke with him, visited with them for a while. And then the whole thing is just kind of cloudy from that point. We're told that Deborah went inside the house somewhere around 10:30-ish, and that was the last time that she checked in on Lisa. At that time, Samantha goes over next door to her house. Not clear on how long Shane was with her or if he even left at that point. she gets a text message from James Brando, her now estranged husband, who has moved with a friend about 5 miles away temporarily. And she gets a text message from him saying that he loves her. Her and the daughter and Maria. And then Samantha texts him back in about a half hour, I believe it is, and tells him the same. And then at 11:57 p.m., we are told that there was an attempted phone call made from Deborah Bradley has three phones at that time. One of them is a working phone, but it's not got paid up yet. It's hotlined or redlined, whatever you call it, and it goes. Outgoing calls go to the to a recording. So an attempt at 11:57 for a phone call from Deborah's working plain Jane phone that Grandpa had loaned her. That is attempted for Megan Wright's phone. There it clouds the issue there.
Yes, yes.
Now, I've said all along, you know, that phone call attempt is key to know who attempted the call and who the call was intended for. Mm-hmm. Was the call intended for Megan Wright? Was the call intended for Jersey, John Tanko, who had broken up with her and him and Megan Wright broke up about a week and a half earlier? Mm-hmm. Did the person trying to get a hold of them not know that they were broke up? And we also asked at one time, was it intended for Dane Greathouse, because Dane was living in that house temporarily using that phone all night? I now say with a high degree of certainty that I do not believe it was intended for Dane. I've been given access to Megan's cell phone records that night. That call did not go through. So Dane could have just been the unlucky sap using a free phone that night,
mm-hmm.
and just happened to be, you know, brought into the picture net this way.
So it doesn't really, it's just one of those red, you think it might just be a red herring that has nothing to
I
do with
so.
The case. Okay.
I think so, yeah.
That's
and I
interesting.
I could be wrong on that. Yeah, I could be wrong, but because it didn't go through, who would know that Dane was on the other end of the line? Because I'm told by members of the household there, and I've been to that house probably a good 3 or 4 times talking to the folks that live there. I'm told that Dane used the phone off and on all night, but he crashed on the couch, I'm thinking 3 a.m., I believe it was, and, slept through the night there. Now, back to the timeline, there's a alleged sighting of a male, a white male with a baby in their arms at around 12:15. This sighting is one street over, going through the yard, a neighbor's yard who lives on Chelsea, one street over. These people say that this is the route that this John Tanko Jersey commonly took through the neighborhood. So again, was it Jersey or was it someone who just happened to be taking the route, or was it someone who wanted to make it look like Jersey, or again, you know, a red herring, who knows. Jersey was working that night, or staying that night, on that street on Chelsea at a man's house named Denny Watson.
Mm-hmm.
Denny and his wife were out of town. He had Jersey there watering his lawn, turning on the sprinklers because he had just seeded his lawn. A good time of year for it, October 3rd. And Denny Watson's wife would not allow anybody to have access to the house, so they had a storage shed out back and allowed Jersey to stay there. I'm told, and haven't been able to confirm, that Jersey had been down at one of the casinos at Harrah's that night and was asked to leave, that he was trespassing. So that would be interesting to finally piece that together.
Yes, that's it. I haven't heard that. Okay.
Yeah, you know, as far as an alibi for him,
mm-hmm. Right.
We do know that the next morning that lawn was pretty soaked and muddy because sprinklers weren't shut off on a timely nature.
Mm-hmm.
We also know that Jersey had been hit by a car on North Brighton about a week or so earlier, and the next door neighbor to Denny Watson had given him ice earlier that day for his knee and for his alcohol because he couldn't get into Denny's house. Just a little bit of rewind, too, to that. The previous day, that same neighbor had taken Jersey to church. Spent some time with him, and she had brought or invited a gentleman and his son home from church for Sunday lunch, and Jersey had spent Sunday dinner with them, and the gentleman and his son left early because he found out that Jersey offered the kids some pot. So, you know, that just kind of, that's color to the whole situation with Jersey.
And there's lots of color in this story, I'll tell you. All kinds of things.
That's a polite way of putting it.
Yeah, unbelievable.
So then back to the night Lisa went missing, the 1157 phone call, we moved forward, and there's an alleged, if we believe what we're told, there's an alleged ping on the phones, either an attempt to access Deborah Bradley's voicemail or an attempt to use her internet. She indicates that that phone didn't have internet access, so was it trying to get the voicemail, and if so, who would want to have access to her voicemail? But anyway, that was at 3:17, 3:22. The pings have us about a third of a mile within her house, which could be at the house, it could be in the creek out back near the creek. It could be at any one of these vacant houses that Jersey had access to. A third of a mile covers a lot of area. Oh, I failed to mention there was a dumpster fire at about 2:30. About a quarter of a mile up the road around the corner at an apartment complex. Now, what makes this interesting is, first, Jersey has a history of enjoying the use of fire, a polite way of putting that. And he also allegedly torched Megan Wright's car at that same apartment complex some days earlier. And
interesting.
So, yeah, so that kind of, you know, this thing gets very complicated. I'm told that within the first 3 hours of Deborah's interrogation, the day of Lisa's going missing, that she was shown a photograph of burnt clothes. I'm also told that those clothes did not appear to be Lisa's clothes. So was this an unrelated fire? Did law enforcement go out, to try to get someone to what they think will be a confession? Did they go out and buy baby clothes, set them afire, take a photograph, bring it into the interrogation? There's just a lot of questions in that area. So then there's also a sighting at a BP gas station about that same time, but about the 2:30 time frame. Now, I, along with several others, believe that this alleged sighting is nothing. The man that you see across the street from the BP gas station walking in a white T-shirt appears to be swinging his arms. I've discussed this with both Jim Spellman of CNN, Peter Alexander of NBC, and we all kind of feel like this is just a moot point. There's nothing with this. Now, it had been reported in the media, you know, that he come from out of a wooded area at the intersection, I believe, of Parvin and Brighton. However, having driven that area now many times, that's not what I would characterize a wooded area. It's more of a tree line that separates a open field area from a residential neighborhood.
So it's not this big wooded forest that everybody is talking about. Ron, we do have a question from a caller. Do you mind taking a caller real quickly?
No, not at all.
Okay, we're talking with Ron Rugen and the Lisa Irwin case. Ron has been involved in the case from day one. He lives in the area. And we have Lisa from Pennsylvania. Lisa, welcome to Web Sleuths Radio. And
thank
you're
you.
On the air live, my dear. What is your question for Ron?
Thank you. I have a statement as well as a question.
Okay.
First of all, I want to note that I'm a Christian as well, and I do believe there's power in prayer, and I do believe Lisa will be found. However, my question is, why are the searchers, as well as others that are looking for baby Lisa, why are they being threatened?
Are they being threatened?
Yes. In fact, we were all contacted by CNN. They may do a story on this.
Are you a searcher, ma'am?
No, actually, I've worked with detectives. I'm clairvoyant, and I've been working with a detective out in Kansas City, Missouri, and I've actually been threatened.
How have you been threatened? I was sent online.
In fact, I was emailed a threat, and then they submitted a video to me,
You say a threat. That's a very nebulous term.
Well, specifically, what was said to you? That they were going to burn me like a witch.
You know, we don't know where that
was submitted.
We don't know where that's from. It could just be a bunch of stupid kids. That's a problem. I mean, I've known people that have gone out there and searched, and they have never had a problem. When you say the searchers are being threatened, what do you give us an example and tell us why that is?
Okay. In fact, I can read quickly to you a message that I just received on Facebook. I am going to leave this searcher's name out of it. However, she posted that she notes here, she said, the ones that actually have searched, at least two have been threatened. I have been on four of them and kept telling the group we're being watched. And to find out from another searcher, we were photographed. Can't state photos as facts, you know what I mean. More than one good source could confirm that we are being watched. So these individuals that are searchers are actually being photographed by an individual. The photographs apparently have been mailed to them. And the other question I have at hand is the fact that, you know, on these Facebook websites, if you post anything in regard to baby Lisa, more than likely you're going to have somebody with a fictitious profile comment in the derogatory note. This is what I don't understand. This case differs from many cases. I've never seen a missing child's case where people have created hundreds of fictitious profiles, and they come on here and they attack the individuals on a verbal note, of course, written on Facebook, you know, and my head's spinning. I can't
You want to talk about threats? One of the lead searchers in this case has come up with what she believes to be is my home address. Now, tell me that's not a threat toward me and threat in terms of intimidation. A, I'm pretty hard to find my home address unless you know me as an individual. But B, why is my home address any way, shape, or form relevant to anything that I do in this investigation when I have a business office in an office building in downtown Kansas City that I work out of? So, you know, you talk about threats. Let's be fair here on all sides, because I think some of this is histrionic behavior. It gets to the point of just being ridiculous. I have had attacks, written attacks online made against me by both, primarily those who believe Deborah is culpable for what happened. Now the quote-unquote huggers, have been slamming me. I've had people on those pages attack my children and brought them into this. If that's not intimidation, I don't know what is, and I'm not sure how my children, my grown adult children, how my personal life, how my home, potential home address, thankfully it wasn't, why someone needs to put my potential home address and a map, a Google visible map of where they think my residence is, and pretend like that this might have an impact on the case.
Well, Ron, let me tell you something. Welcome to the world of internet sleuthing. And I have taken Lisa off the air. First of all, I like what you said about hysteria. That when I hear these types of stories, I just go, here we go again. If this is a case, go to the police. Take the evidence to the police. Don't post it on WebSleuth. Don't do anything else. Go to the police. If someone is bothering you, don't post on Facebook. I mean,
Exactly.
I mean, it's just so simple. It's almost like they I don't know. They get all involved and they want to find out. And no, just stay away. if you're a volunteer and you're being threatened or you feel scared, stay the hell away, get off the internet, and go on with your life. Okay.
And I'm sure, Trisha, I'm sure some of this, to some small degree, may be going on. But I really, that's why I tried to be, put my reporter hat for a moment. I wanted to be real specific as to what she viewed as a threat, because
exactly.
I think there's a lot of histrionics in this, and there's accusations, and there's people that live and breathe this thing 24 hours a day, and it's like,
mm-hmm.
come on, folks, take a breath, walk away from it, get a life.
Yeah.
And, I mean, we all care that Lisa's missing, but for crying out loud, get a damn life.
Mm-hmm. And don't read every, if you see a post on Facebook, don't turn it into a threat. And if there is a threat, go to the police, for God's sakes. Just go
exactly.
and stay off of Facebook and get away from the case if someone's threatening you. It's not worth it. You're not doing anything to help by creating all this drama. And, yeah, you're right. I'm sure some of it is true. But, Ron, I see this all the time, and you can tell I'm getting upset, because it makes me crazy. When I see this type of histrionic behavior, it makes the rest of us look bad. You know, because then the police say, well, you're all the same, all the people on the internet. No, we're not. You know, and I tell people, I get this all the time. I'm afraid for my safety. You know, I shouldn't be posting. Well, don't post. If you're afraid
exactly.
for your safety, stop. Get off the internet. Make it go. You have the power to make it go away. And I'm sorry somebody did that to you, Ron. Doesn't surprise me. I've had it done to me, except
mine was my house.
So yeah.
You'd be surprised at. And I won't say as a degree of professionalism, but you would be surprised at the person who participated in that. That is a very visible person involved in the searches. And we'll leave it at that, because I don't want to pursue this and make
mm-hmm.
it revisit.
It'll just be more drama. And guess
yeah.
what? Who gets lost in all of it? Lisa. That's who gets lost in it.
That's exactly it. You know, and frankly, I mean, nobody's asked me to get involved in this case. Nobody's, hired me. Nobody's asked me to do what I've done. And frankly, I could walk away, but I'm close here. I have the ability. People have talked to me, members of Megan's household and others. And I've undergone some of that same kind of scrutiny, and I just got to the point that I shut Facebook down and walked away and went on with my life. And
mm-hmm.
it's like I told Deborah, about the forest and the tree. If you don't hear the tree, or if you're not there and hear the tree fall, then it didn't fall. So
exactly.
I just don't care to let them have an impact on my health.
Absolutely right. Now, we're going to switch gears here. I want to ask you something. And we've covered this before, but I think it's important to bring it out again. We've had a question about the cadaver dog reacting in the bedroom. That seems to be just a big thing that people have. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. Was this cadaver dog, was it a true search and rescue dog or not? I'm hearing different stories. Tell us what you know about that.
What I know is it was a scent dog, a cadaver dog, and I'm told that in spite of Cacopina's suggestions that it could have hit on toenails or a poopy diaper or that kind of thing, that these dogs are trained at I can't recall what the phrase is, but they have a farm where they train them at, and they actually have bodies in different degrees of decomposition.
The body farm in Tennessee, right.
Yeah, that's it, yeah. And so, it's really, really tough to get away from that cadaver dog kit. If you go with Cacopina's suggestion that it was a poopy diaper, those of us, I raised three kids, those of us who we changed them on the living room floor, on the couch,
mm-hmm.
on the changing table, on your bed, why was there not another hit if that's what the situation was?
Somewhere else.
Was?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking with Ron Rubin, private investigator, about the Lisa Irwin case. Lisa Irwin went missing this past December, and baby, she's a toddler. And, Ron, let's get back to some of the case players here. You said about the cousin from Texas. We are going to get back to the cousin from Texas. Tell us about this person.
Well, Mike Lorette is from the Houston, Texas area. He's as far as I can see, the person who got the benefactor involved in this case. Mike is a cousin to Deborah. Mike's mother lives here not far away from Deborah. And so he's been up here over the course of time. Now, and this is kind of what got me in a little bit of hot water with the family and distance from them a little bit, is that I had a couple reporters tell me, and that they've known this for some time, that apparently Mike has had some sort of relationship with Samantha Bradley, the next door neighbor.
Oh, okay. wow.
And you know, at first, when you say that out loud, you know, it sounds like, you know, a trivial little gossip, but it's you know, anything in this case is kind of interesting things to piece together when you can't have an answer to this case.
Mm-hmm.
But I won't mention the reporters' names, but I was told that they had known that for 3 months, which is why I was, you know, I discussed it out loud, because does that make James, Samantha's husband, an interesting character? In terms of did James believe that Deborah had a hand in his marriage falling apart, or, you know, something of that nature. But I think Mike Lorette, from what I can see, is kind of the conduit between Jeremy and Deborah and Takapina and Stanton. He's a former Marine, and I think, from what I'm told, that he may be involved with some real estate or something, but he comes up here on occasion, from what I can see, on his Twitters, and he went with them to New York to the Dr. Phil show taping via satellite.
Mm-hmm.
And I have reason to believe that Deborah, at least, I don't know about Jeremy, but I have reason to believe that maybe Deborah didn't really want to do the Dr. Phil show at first, and I'm curious, I'm wondering if Mr. Lorette didn't kind of serve as a go-between for Takapina and talk him into doing the show.
Understood. Can you talk about any of the interviews you have done lately or not?
I can talk a little bit. I met last night for about 45 minutes with James Brando.
And who is he again? Tell me again so we can
James
get that.
James is the next door neighbor,
right?
And he still lives next door. Samantha, his wife, estranged wife, she's filed for divorce in early December now. She now lives with her mother at another location here locally.
Mm-hmm.
James works, or at the time Lisa went missing, he was working at Rosecrans Air Base up in St. Joseph, and that's about 60 minutes northwest of here. He has now gone back to his previous job, which is in Sprint telephone intelligence, they call it, or surveillance, I think the unit is called. And so his characterization of what he does there is sitting behind a desk working on cell phone surveillance issues through the day, as far as, you know, getting cell pings and things like that for that kind of thing. But I'll be doing a blog on my conversation with James, and I think I'll have it out tomorrow evening if I it depends on what all else goes on. But so I visited with James last night. And another interesting thing that's happened in the last 36 hours is Dane, we talked about earlier, who was using Megan Wright's cell phone that night, has now been arrested and is being charged for stabbing a man, I believe it was early yesterday morning, near this area here. Nothing related to the Lisa Irwin case as far as the stabbing goes, but just the fact that, you know, we know Dane from this other direction now.
Lovely. Oh, lovely group of people. Oh, my gosh. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. Well, I'm looking forward to that blog of yours. I'm real interested in what Brando had to say here. Ron, let's kind of wrap things up a little bit. where do we stand now? It just seems like we are in the exact same place we were the night or the morning Lisa went missing. Are we any closer? What is going on?
It appears on the outside that that's the case. I will tell you that. Let me just say that I've been criticized by some by putting a lot of information out on my blog. Now, the reason I put information out there, some say, well, you know, a PI wouldn't be doing that. Well, I'm not a PI hired on this case. Due to the fact that I have not been retained by anybody on this case, I am certainly have opened myself up to being a witness in this case because I don't have any attorney work privilege on this, not working for any attorneys. So, you know, I don't owe any, I don't know if allegiance was the word on that, but the interesting thing about it is that you know, I put information out on my blog to hopefully get other people to think about maybe something that they saw. There are other things that happened that night. And when I put it out there, people might think, wow, I can add to that, or I saw something. Now, I'll tell you one thing that happened that night that's not really been discussed is a red SUV, I believe it was, in the neighborhood, going through the neighborhood a couple times. And there's another character whose father lives down the street from Lisa's parents and sometimes sits in this SUV in a field and may have some... maybe a little bit challenged if what I'm told is correct. So, you know, there's another character, you know, that really hasn't even been talked about that's an interesting character. But as far as things progressing, I will tell you that not everything that I find, not everything I run across is put in my blog. There's enough information out there that people can use it to maybe add to it or follow this case, but I will tell you that there are other things that I'm looking at that we just won't discuss. I made Deborah a promise, and I'm sticking to that, no matter, you know, how anybody feels about me, good, bad, or indifferent, and that in case Lisa is still out there and safe somewhere tonight, that I'm not going to do anything that is going to deter her coming home safely. And I am not going to put anything out there that if we believe we're getting close, is going to make someone run the other direction and make it that much tougher for us to find answers.
Thank you. Thank you, Ron. We do have one more question. This is from Edith. She wants to thank you. And so let's get Edith on the air. Is that okay, Ron?
Yes.
Okay. Edith, you're live on Web Sleuth Radio talking with Ron Rugen, private investigator in the Lisa Irwin case. Go ahead, my dear.
Hi, Ron. This is Edie. You know me. I just want to thank you for everything you're doing, and thank you for everything, you know, keeping Lisa's name out there. You know, we're working together. We will stay working here in Kansas City. You know, we just had a beautiful prayer vigil for her today. I wish you could have been there. But anyway, thank you guys for keeping it out on the radio for us, you know. Because, you know, the word out there is keeping her name out there. We will find her soon. Thank you.
Thank you, Edith. That was very sweet. See, Ron, there's nice people out there that appreciate you too, like Edith, right?
If you say so.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
We'll talk off the air, Trisha, after we're done.
Okay. All right. Hey, Ron, you have just been such a sweetheart, and I really, really appreciate you. Give us the address of your blog, please, so everybody will know what it is.
Okay, thank you very much. My blog is at http://KansasCityPI, all one word, KansasCityPI.blogspot.com. And I've had a lot of folks trying to friend me on Facebook. I have my own personal page or my own personal Facebook for friends and everything, and I don't use it to discuss the Lisa Irwin case. If you want to follow me on Facebook, my business page is facebook.com/KansasCityPI. So it's a pretty universal thing, KansasCityPI on both the blogspot.com as well as the Facebook page.
Well, thank you, my dear. Thank you so much, Ron. And we'll talk off air. We can trade crazy people stories, and we can tell each other what to watch out for. You are a true, wonderful human being. Thank you for everything, and we will be talking to you soon. If there's anything we can do for you on Web Sleuth, don't hesitate to ask, okay?
You're very kind, and the Web Sleuth folks have been very kind to me. They've embraced me coming onto your old forums, and boy, they ask some really good questions.
They do. They're smart people.
Yeah, they are, and I appreciate you having me on, not for my sake, but for keeping Lisa's name and awareness out there, and I appreciate all that. All y'all are doing, and if you need to get in touch with me at any time, again, you know, that's the contact information there on Facebook, and I'm happy to visit with anybody to discuss this case.
Thank you, Ron. You take care. Thanks for giving us your time tonight.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Sir. Oh, Kimster, are you with us still?
Yes, I am. Hello there.
Hi there. You know, when I told Ron, I said, do you mind if we take some calls? And he said, no. And I said, you know, I think we'll have some, you know, normal people calling, and I don't know what to think now. It was just, I just don't know. So anyway, we'll have Ron Rugen on again soon, I'm sure, to talk about the Lisa Irwin case. But now we are going to move on to the Web Sleuth Hot Cold case, and this is where Kimster shines. Kimster, tell us about the Web Sleuth Hot Cold case, please.
I would love to. This week's hot cold case is about Mary Ellen Caldenburg from Kenosha, Wisconsin. And we're here because Mary Ellen's cousin, Help the Victims, is a member on Web Sleuth. I'm going to read what she wrote on a post in Mary Ellen's thread. Quote, in 1967, my cousin, Mary Ellen Caldenburg, was murdered in Kenosha, Wisconsin on approximately February 9th. She was found brutally stabbed on February 14, 1967, in an old abandoned hearse near the railroad tracks. She had walked from her home to the store and was to return back home quickly as she was meeting her boyfriend for a date. There have been numerous theories to include serial killers and possible suspects. However, to date, this case has gone unsolved. It seems to have been put to the bottom of the pile due to lack of evidence. The police detectives have worked diligently for many years to solve this, and still nobody has been brought to justice. It has been 44 years since her murder. Her mother went to her grave never knowing who killed her only daughter. I decided to reach out to the public and create an awareness about this case, and with any luck and the help of God and his angels, just maybe we can find out who killed this innocent young girl, end quote. There's more information about this case, Tricia, on Web Sleuth. So everybody out there, please visit Mary Ellen's thread by going to websleuth.com and following the link that shows her case. It's in the upper right-hand corner of the page. And say hello to her dear cousin, Help the Victims, who is trying to find out who Mary Ellen's murderer was.
Wow, that is truly a cold case. 1967, and to be found in an abandoned hearse, I mean, that's just gruesome. And you have to wonder, is there DNA evidence somewhere in the pile of evidence at the police station that just hasn't been tested yet? Boy, that's a tough one.
Yeah, there's a lot more twists and turns that our wonderful sleuthers have come up with. There is some discussion on that thread, so be sure to visit and see what you might see that they haven't brainstormed yet.
And again, I want to stress, even if you're not into sleuthing, if you think, oh, hey, I don't want to say anything, just say hello to the family. It will mean so much to them. And you, by doing that one thing, will make a huge difference. Right, Kimster?
Oh, absolutely. I'm sure Help the Victims would love to have you come and post there and say hello to her.
That's it. That's all you need to do. Well, thanks, everybody, for joining us. It was a very, very interesting show. Thanks to all the people in the chat room. I do appreciate you. Kimster is always working hard behind the scenes, making me look good, making it look easy. And Kimster is one doing all the hard work. So thank you, Kimster. I do appreciate everything you do. Thank you for joining us tonight, Web Sleuth Radio, where we discuss true crime, current events, and we always do it with common sense. Thanks, everybody. Good night.